I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. It took 13 months for video to surface of Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old black teenager, being gunned down by a policeman in Chicago. Why did it take so long, and how will authorities in Chicago be held accountable? McDonald's killing is putting into sharp focus issues of transparency in city police departments, as well as how police handle suspects who are on drugs. I speak with a Chicago journalist and a former Maryland cop. And just in time for award season and a slew of holiday releases, we check in with our movie know-it-alls, Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival. Plus, Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story, and we'll share with you the music that will soon become the new Maryland Morning theme song. We'll start with the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad to have you with us this morning. From Freddie Gray in Baltimore to Laquan McDonald in Chicago, tensions between police and communities of color continue to be at a fever pitch. Two issues in particular are receiving increased attention. Number one, transparency by police and other government officials when alleged acts of police misconduct occur. And number two, the consequences of the so-called war on drugs, which has led to huge rates of arrests and incarceration. Now, a conversation with two people who have thought a lot about the policing issues that cities, suburbs, and rural areas around the nation are struggling with. Jamie Calvin joins us by phone from Chicago. He's a writer and the executive director of the Invisible Institute, which has been instrumental in making internal police documents about police misconduct cases available to the public, including making public the police dash cam video and autopsy report in the Laquan McDonald case. Welcome, Mr. Calvin.
It's good to be with you.
And Neil Franklin also joins us by phone from San Francisco. He's the executive director of LEAP, L-E-A-P, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He was undercover in the early 1980s and was also the commanding officer of drug and criminal enforcement on the Eastern Shore. He grew up in Reservoir Hill here in Baltimore and worked for a while in Baltimore City as the head of training for the Baltimore City Police Department. Mr. Franklin, thank you for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
Jamie Calvin, obviously here in Baltimore, we're thinking a lot about police misconduct and related issues. The first of six trials in the death of Freddie Gray is in its fifth day as we speak. In Chicago last month, your organization, the Invisible Institute, released a database of more than 56,000 Chicago police misconduct complaints records that involve more than 8,500 Chicago police officers. This database is on the web. It's called the Citizens Police Data Project. Give us a quick summary of how this came to be put together.
So it's the product of almost a decade of litigation and public advocacy that culminated in March 2014 with an appellate court decision in Illinois that held that police misconduct files are public information. And having won that decision, we were able to access the information that you made reference to and have put a lot of energy into trying to make it really legible and useful for citizens, for journalists, for civil rights lawyers.
It's been posted online for a month or so now. What have you learned as you look at this data?
You know, I think what the data, so you can learn things about individual officers, about their complaint histories. And again, most recently in the case of Laquan McDonald, there something happens, there's a criminal prosecution of an officer, and it becomes apparent that there were multiple occasions provided by citizen complaints of misconduct to have intervened earlier, and no action was taken. More generally, the database provides a kind of portrait of impunity, really. It's just extraordinarily unlikely, on the basis of the city's own statistics and data, that that abuse will be identified, seriously investigated, and disciplined. So what it really demonstrates is the kind of space that exists, the impunity that exists for that small but not insignificant subset of officers who are disposed to be abusive, in whatever form, racist, corrupt, brutal. They know that they will be unlikely ever to be punished in any significant way, and the database really reflects that reality.
And the database, does it include, it just includes all of the complaints that were registered. Does it include any information about the disposition of those complaints? In other words, were some of them dismissed?
Yeah, it does. So what we have are the allegation, the officer demographic information about the officer, demographic information about the victim, and the ultimate disposition of the complaint. And I don't have the figures in front of me as we speak, but a very, very high number of complaints, well over 90% of complaints, are found to be not sustained, which is a kind of shrug of the shoulders. We couldn't even come to a determination.
Mm-hmm.
Of those that are sustained, an infinitesimal number lead to any kind of meaningful punishment. So, as I say, this is a system that really is dedicated to kind of not knowing things that the police department is capable of knowing, and the city is capable of knowing about fundamental human rights abuses. There is no, we have depositions from city officials and police department officials in which they have been candid about the fact that they do no pattern analysis with this, really precious information.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't look at high numbers of complaints of individual officers, the pattern of particular allegations, groups of officers working together. Imagine a corporation that didn't do that kind of quality control if it had this sort of feedback from its customers.
As we finish up with this part of our discussion today, Mr. Calvin, the city of Chicago over the last 10 years, which is the period of time encompassed in your study, has paid, according to some reports, particularly by the Better Government Association, according to the New Yorker magazine, more than $521 million in settlements with people who've complained about police misconduct. Is that basically the way they've been able to keep this information private for as long as they have?
I think that's part of the machinery. I mean, the figure is $500 million over 10 years in legal awards and settlements. And so part of the machinery, there are other elements in this sort of, machinery of not knowing, not disclosing the realities, are these settlements. And, the numbers are huge. I mean, imagine if $500 million had been devoted to sort of reparations and really meaningful reform in making a more vigorous accountability system.
Sure.
So I think that's something that bears close examination now.
Jamie Calvin is the director of the Invisible Institute, joins us on the phone from Chicago. Neil Franklin is in San Francisco. Thank you, Mr. Franklin, for getting up so bright and early. Tell us a little bit about the organization you head, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Why are you against prohibition of, I assume you're talking about drugs here?
Yeah, absolutely. We're an organization. We were formed in 2002 by two police officers on the East Coast, one a retired lieutenant from New Jersey State Police and another captain from a town in New York State. And the premise here is the prohibition of drugs, some refer to it as the war on drugs, is the one single issue that causes more problems in more areas of the lives of not just the people in the United States, but globally, than any other single issue. So, for instance, the initial goals of the war on drugs was to reduce crime, disease, death, and addiction. Each one of those categories has gotten worse over the past four decades since Nixon coined the phrase back in the 1970s. And we compare it to alcohol prohibition of the 1920s, which only lasted 13 years. And it only lasted 13 years because of the violence that was generated from the sale and manufacture and transportation of illicit booze. And, organized crime and criminals like Al Capone, speaking about Chicago, from Chicago, tried to corner the market, and doing so, they used guns to manage that illicit, bootlegging industry. And we see the very same thing today with drive-by shootings and running gun battles, and as young boys try to corner the market share in many of our urban centers. They use guns to do the same thing. So it has increased crime. It goes against public safety, corruption that comes from that, mass incarceration. We imprison more people in the United States than any other country in the world. We're only 5% of the world's population here, but we have almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. Most of those people are imprisoned for drug-related crimes.
Do you make a distinction between certain drugs that, you know, may or may not be legalized? I mean, obviously there's a movement towards legalizing marijuana, and most folks would point to a big difference between that and legalizing crack cocaine.
Well, it's not really about the drug. I mean, even consider that drugs are potentially dangerous. Let's just make that a given. If they are so problematic and dangerous, the worst thing you can do is turn the market over to criminal organizations to manage within our communities. You first have to realize, and I hope people do, that it's impossible to have a drug-free society. We as people have never been drug-free, and we never will be. So it's about managing drugs within your communities the best way possible to reduce harm to the lowest possible level. And you have to do that through regulation. You can't do that through prohibition. I hope we learned that lesson by now. So that's what it's about. It's about the policy for managing drugs. Drugs are neither good or bad. You can't have a war against a glass sitting on a table. It's about what makes the glass either dangerous or not dangerous is the environment in which you use it. If you break it and you cut yourself because you're not using it properly, yeah, it's dangerous. But if you use it properly, it's not. It's the same thing with drugs. So this is about policy. It's not about good drugs versus bad drugs.
That right. Doesn't make sense. Well, I'm sorry that's all the time we have this morning, but I'm very grateful to both of you for sharing your perspective. Thanks so much. Neil Franklin is formerly with the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore City Police Department. He's now the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Monday night, he'll appear at a forum sponsored by the Open Society Institute. It's called Talking About Addiction, Rethinking the Role of Law Enforcement. He'll be joined on that panel by Leonard Campanello, the Police Chief of Gloucester, Massachusetts. That event begins at 7 o'clock at the 2640 space in Charles Village. Thanks to Jamie Calvin, for joining us from Chicago this morning as well. Coming up, our movie mavens join me in the studio, and later on, we'll share with you the music that will soon become Maryland Morning's new theme song. First, here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
That music can only mean that it's time for the monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. Glad you're back with us here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Joining me in the studio, Ann Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Happy holidays.
Thank you, sir.
Always good to see you. And Jed Dietz, returning triumphantly from the royal wedding that we heard so much about last month. Things went well.
Beautifully, thanks. Yeah, it was really great.
So you're still married, no? That's good. Decades of marriage. Renewing your vows when your son gets married. That's true. Well, congratulations and love to all. So plenty of movies, you know, coming out these days, the Christmas rush. There's a Spike Lee movie that's getting a lot of lot of buzz here, and it's called Chi-Raq. It's directed, by, as I said, by Spike Lee, and it's an adaptation of Lysistrata.
Indeed.
Which, if I recall my Greek plays correctly, this is where women withhold sex from men until they agree to stop fighting wars.
Exactly, yes. And Spike Lee has transposed that story and that conceit to modern-day Chicago, which we know all too well is mired in the same kind of violence that we know so well here in Baltimore.
So Chi-Raq, the title, is actually a takeoff
on
Iraq.
Absolutely, and it starts with just a... You know, one of my favorite things about Spike's movies are his opening sequences. I just think he prepares an audience so beautifully for what they're about to experience. And this one is no different. He starts with this really compelling rap delivered by Nick Cannon, who also stars in the film. It's just this cry of the heart to Chicago and regarding gun violence, and he shows these statistics about how gun deaths in Chicago have outpaced American deaths in both Afghanistan and Iraq. So it is a crazy, mixed-up mess of a masterpiece of a movie. I mean, it's such an audacious idea. Most of the film is delivered in verse. Like I said, Nick Cannon plays a gangbanger slash rapper named Chirac. His girlfriend, Liz Estrada, played by Tonya Paris, in just an absolutely electrifying performance, hits on this idea to gather the women folk of her neighborhood and also the women of the opposing gang to enact a sex strike. All the way through, Sam Jackson appears as sort of the Greek chorus figure who is just absolutely hilarious and biting and funny and urgent. John Cusack plays a Catholic priest who just delivers a stem winder of a sermon regarding all of the. I don't want people to misunderstand that Lee and his collaborator, Kevin Wilmot, who wrote the Confederate States of America, CSA, which was a really clever satire about a political history in which the South would have won the Civil War. I don't think this is simplistically, suggesting that a sex strike would work, but it's really just a conceit to raise so many issues, historical, political, economic, even spiritual, personal, psychological. I mean, there's just so much in this movie, and it is so deeply felt. It's uneven. It's a little bit unsteady at times, but it is just so suffused with passion and urgency and beauty that it's one of the most exciting things he's done in years.
You call it a mess of a masterpiece.
Yeah.
That's something. Because the structure of it alone just sounds like it's extraordinary and unlike anything else that we're encountering
it is.
In film.
It is, and it's a little unwieldy. And I think, sometimes I feel like his cinematic instincts are so dead on. I mean, he's really one of the most instinctive filmmakers I think I can think of. But I think when he gets in his own way, he tries to mess with that a little too much. And I do think that kind of pops up here. I mean, there's some polemic that's a little awkward. There's some pacing and, structural issues that are a little bit wobbly. But the whole thing is just so, like I said, it's just such a breathtaking artistic experience.
Yeah.
And again, just so of its time. And it's just exhilarating to see an artist engage his times the way he's doing it here.
Yeah, and Jed, we've talked before on the show about Spike Lee and the fact that he is so present in the moment so many times. I mean, when the Malcolm X movie came out or when he does historical fiction or historical narrative fiction, it's always very incredible. I wonder, what's your take? I mean, as a guy in the movie business, the fact that Chicago itself is so much in the news this very week, with an alleged cover-up on the part of the mayor and the police chief, this video of the shooting by the police officer of Laquan McDonald, was suppressed for more than a year. Does the fact that Chicago is in the news, does that push people to a movie like this? What's the relationship, you think, between contemporary events and films these days?
Oh, I think it for sure pushes people. I mean, the greatest example was China Syndrome, which, came around a great leak of energy coming out of one of our nuclear plants. And it became a huge hit. And I think Spike Lee, through his whole career, has had a feel of the whole culture, not just the filmmaking. What Anne said is right. I mean, I think he's a very instinctive filmmaker. I think he's a very instinctive citizen. And I think I haven't seen this yet. It opens tonight at the Charles. I can't wait to see it. And now even reinforced by what Anne said. But I think it's very much about Spike and his ideas about what's going on in our culture.
We have a little clip from Spike Lee's movie Chirac. Here it is.
Homicides in Chicago, Illinois, have surpassed the death toll of American special forces in Iraq.
Hey, it's all the media.
Welcome to Chirac.
Chirac, where we at, my city?
Land of pain, misery, and strife.
Everybody here got a man banging and slanging, fighting for the flag, risking that long zip of the cadaver back.
All to the bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
It all started with a gorgeous Nubian sister.
What's up, Spinner?
They call her Liz Estrada, a woman like no other.
You just try taking away their guns.
Okay, the dirty poppers.
Because my gun go boom, I'll make sure a Trojan end up in the next.
All right. Well, what else do they love?
Repeat after me. I will deny all rights of access or entrance.
Liz Estrada comes to the screen.
Right, and that was Angela Bassett you heard. Wesley Snipes is in it. I mean, it's an amazing cast.
Chirac opens, as Jed mentioned, at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore. tonight. Another movie sort of ripped from the headlines that keep coming. They've been with us now for decades. This movie's Spotlight. Tom McCarthy co-wrote the movie. He's actually was an actor in The Wire here in Baltimore. Mark Ruffalo, Michael Keaton, Rachel McAdams. This is a true story about an investigative team, the Boston Globe, who investigated the massive scandal of child abuse in the Roman Catholic Church. It actually includes your current boss.
That is correct, sir.
Depicted in this movie. So tell us about this.
He's channeled in this movie by Liev Schreiber. It's uncanny how Liev Schreiber can play Marty Baron, who is not known for his effusive over-emoting, shall we say, which even he has admitted.
He's currently an editor at the Washington
Post.
Yes,
he's the executive editor at the Post, the beloved and worshipped executive editor at the Post, and he was literally it was his first day as the editor of the Boston Globe when he suggested that the Spotlight team take on this assignment, much to their skepticism, much to the pushback of some of his colleagues, and of course, much to the consternation of the Catholic Church, which had enjoyed a lot of deference over the years from the Globe and lots of other institutions in the city. I can't say enough about this movie. I think so highly of it. It's a beautifully wrought ensemble drama where McCarthy just lets the story play. He doesn't put any spin on the ball. It is a classic journalistic procedural that I think, for my money, depicts journalism better than almost any movie I can think of in recent memory, including some obvious ones. But even with all of that detail and atmospheric precision, it's an enormously emotional experience. I mean, he doesn't lose the grief and the heart of this, the sorrow at the heart of this story, which I think is the great artistic achievement of the film.
Yeah, and Jed, you saw it and loved it as well.
Yeah, I've seen it twice, actually, at Anne's instruction. I went to see it again.
It does get better.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I would say all the things Anne said about it are in it. There's also incredible humor and human triumph because it's about these professionals, these journalists, quirky people themselves, not perfect people themselves, who are in a culture in Boston. It was all over the world, but specifically in Boston, that was very protective of what they were going after. And some of them were protective of it too, had grown up in this culture in Boston specifically. And what they uncover and the guidance that they get from Marty Baron and others in the higher up in the organization over the Spotlight team to really get the story. For those of us who have not worked in journalism, this is a world that's been hollowed out a little bit, or quite a bit, in many cities. And we're losing something very important. And what replaces it isn't clear.
People don't often think about that, but when we lose print publications, we're losing almost every time this apparatus of investigative journalists who come with the print publication.
And the people who guide them, you know, and both of those things are important when they work well together. There's also, I mean, the sense of discovery in this, it's not like there's some breathtaking moment when it's all sealed up and tied up in a package and handed to you. But there are these little moments where perseverance pays off or a little bit of intuition pays off. And it's really thrilling to go through this process.
Yeah. And of course, it's interesting, you know, when certain professions are lionized in movies, you know, doctors, lawyers, you know, journalists have been, fodder for movies for a long time, ever since Watergate.
Sure,
you know, Watergate movie,
well,
you know,
far before that. I would say Citizen Kane. Yeah,
or Citizen Kane.
Absolutely.
You know, but here's my, and there's another journalism movie, this Dan Rather CBS News movie when his team, you know, met its downfall because of some problems reporting on George W. Bush. So it's interesting to have, you know, journalism back as a plot line.
Well, it's funny because in Truth, that's the portrait of a demise brought on by rushing a story. And in Spotlight, there's just incredible drama in not rushing a story.
Yeah.
I mean, you see them actually sitting on the story when they know they have it, but Mr. Baron just keeps telling them, you know, to keep going. And it's just a riveting, absolutely riveting moment.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Steven Spielberg has what a lot of folks are saying one of his best movies.
Yeah.
We often talk about sort of the smaller indie movies, you know, here on Maryland Morning, but I do want to talk about Bridge of Spies. For several reasons, not the least of which is this is one of the movies I've actually seen.
Yay, so we, Tom!
Once every 4 years, we find a movie that I have seen. So I'm very proud of myself for that. But this is Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, you know, Alan Alda, big, big, huge cast. First of all, I have to say the music in this movie is terrific.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
It's terrific. And it's not by John Williams. It's, now I'm blanking on the guy.
I want to say Thomas Newman,
Thomas Newman,
yeah.
That's right. And because Mr. Williams wasn't available, he's had some health problems, actually. He's in his 80s. But Tom Newman does an unbelievable job.
It was pretty. Yeah.
But this is a Cold War movie in which Mr. Hanks plays a lawyer sent to negotiate the release of a U-2 pilot, a guy named Francis Gary Powers. He was shot down, and they basically worked out an exchange. All of the performances I thought in this movie were incredible. The second tier cast as well as the first tier cast. But Jed, you also think this is one of Spielberg's best.
I do, and I think like Schindler's List, I think what he's done is he tells a great story. He's always been able to do that in film with great actors. But I think it is sort of an indie movie because I think like Schindler's List, which was done as sort of a favor to Spielberg by the studio. Nobody wanted to make that movie. Spielberg has trusted the details of the story and the nuance, not unlike Spotlight, actually, mm-hmm. not unlike independent film making often does. And it's a thrilling story. Hanks is at the top of his game. I think you're right. People you've never recognized before are incredible. There's a little
guy, Mark Rylance.
Yeah, plays the one that
Tom Hanks is trading for Francis Powers. He plays a character named Rudolph Abel.
Yeah.
His face alone is just the most expressive thing I've ever seen.
So I like to only say this to people after they've seen the movie, but I'll spill the beans now. So he was Cromwell in Wolf Hall. And you'll never know it through this movie, and then when it dawns on you, you'll see the linkage.
All right,
it's an amazing performance.
Spoiler alert! But and you're also impressed with this.
I agree, and I think he's the secret to the movie. I mean, I agree. It's a wonderful performance by Hanks. Even Amy Ryan, as his wife, who has relatively little to do, is absolutely perfectly cast. But to me, Rylance makes the movie, and I miss him when he's not on screen. That would be my only caveat: is that he's just such a quiet. I mean, the first, I don't know, several minutes of the film are almost entirely silent. You're just watching him go about his daily life as this deeply, deeply undercover Russian spy in New York. And it's, again, it's riveting. I mean, you're just, so I agree. I think it's definitely amongst Spielberg's best. I was a big fan of Lincoln, and it reminds me a lot of that, too. I mean, it's just, it's a return, and, you know, Spotlight's part of this, too. And we're going to be talking about other movies in the weeks and months to come. There's been a real return to, I think, just fundamentals with a lot of these films. They're just very stalwart, straight ahead, very little spin on the ball, but just superb artistry at work and trusting the tale, trusting your actors, trusting your own chops just to get it done without a lot of bells and whistles.
And often making, you know, Spielberg obviously has any tool of filmmaking available to him every minute. And to make simple choices, as he does over and over, which just fits the story, is wonderful to see.
Yeah, great stuff. All right, so Bridge of Spies, Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks, Mark Rylance, et cetera. Jed, before we finish up, we're going to come back after the break, talk about some of the awards that have just been, the nominations for some of the awards that have been announced. But I want to talk about a movie that was featured at the Maryland Film Festival called Christmas Again, Christmas movie. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is just coming out. We had a screening here, sort of a preview screening, Tuesday over at MICA, and the director, Charlie, was in and met with the film departments and had a great...
Charge Pokel, do I say his
exactly
name?
Right, yeah.
The director.
And it's a small movie with beautifully acted about a guy who sold Christmas trees on the streets of New York, which Charlie did actually for a while. And again, full of detail of exactly what that job is like and the people you interact with during that job in this sort of funny retail way. It opens at MoMA. And then we'll be available in, you know, DVD and Amazon Prime and on demand and all that stuff.
Christmas Again. More movies when we come back after a break for news with Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. Ann Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, joining me here in the studio, along with Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. You guys, I want to talk about the awards. It's now the award season is coming up. It culminates with the Oscars, which is, I guess, what, late February, early March, something like that. So, Jed, the short list for documentaries has been released. And this is important because it does play into not just the Oscars, but a whole bunch of other awards competitions as well. What does that mean?
So the Academy does something in this category they don't do anywhere else. And I don't think any of the other award programs do this too, where they announce a culled list of all the documentaries that have come out hoping for Oscars. And they now have published a list of, as of Wednesday, of 15 titles. And then in January, that'll go to five, and then one of those at the award will be chosen as the best documentary of the world.
So the other categories, you know, best picture and best foreign films, they're not limited in the number of things that might be nominated? Is that how this works?
They're limited, but you don't see the process. You don't, they don't go to 20 and then go to 10 for the best picture. But they just tell you, they can go from 5 to 10 in best picture. So they just announce what they're going to announce in January sometime.
So, but for documentaries, they make it a point to sort of cull the herd a little bit before the voting starts and people's attention starts being allocated.
Exactly.
So, there's some surprises of, you know, what's on and what's not on the list?
Yeah, I would say I haven't seen everything on the list. We've had some of them at the festival, Best of Enemies, for instance. And I saw Meru at the Charles, which I loved about mountain climbing. So I haven't seen everything, but I think it's a good list. There are many on here, the ones that I haven't seen that I'd like to see. It's shocking to me that the Black Panther film, Stanley Nelson's great film, but the Black Panthers, which played the Charles, we had it at the festival, drew huge crowds all the way through and has done that around the country. And it's a magnificent film. A Wolfpack, which was our closing night film about this group of young guys who were sort of contained in an apartment by their family for a long time and is magnificent and got a good run in theaters, is not on the list. And the Kurt Cobain doc, whose name the something
Montage of Heck.
Montage of Heck, which I loved as a music documentary. And I'm not a big Cobain fan, but I think it's an incredible film. It wasn't on the list.
Yeah, so, interesting. Yeah. So, Ann Hornaday, a few have been announced so far. The National Board of Review Awards have been announced. The 25th Annual Gotham Independent Film Awards have been announced. The New York Film Critics Circle has been announced. Interestingly, for those three things, three totally different movies are, you know, up for best or I guess have been
awarded
already. This
is
already. So in the National Board of Review Awards, Mad Max Fury Road is the best film. Best feature film in Gotham is Spotlight, which we were just talking about before the news. And then the best picture in the New York Film Critics Circle, Carol, which is a Christmas movie, which opens Christmas Day. Tell us about Carol first.
I will. This is a wonderful film that I saw first at Cannes in May and have been eagerly awaiting being able to tell people about it. It's written and directed by directed by Todd Haynes from a script by Phyllis Nagy, adapted from a Patricia Highsmith novel called The Price of Salt, about two women falling in love in 1950s New York and battling with all of the homophobia and closet issues that were abroad in the culture at that time. Kate Blanchett and Rooney Mara play the central couple in this sort of exquisitely observed chamber piece where, you know, Haynes, when he did the movie Far From Heaven, he was sort of delivering an homage to Douglas Sirk and those kind of high gloss melodramas of the 1950s where the surfaces really masked so much emotion going on and were able to kind of translate a lot of the meaning that was going on under the surface. And he's doing the same thing here in a way that is just so deeply emotional, just an absolutely beautifully realized film.
Interesting. So the best actor for the National Board of Review Awards was Matt Damon in The Martian. That's interesting. And Gotham, the Gotham Independent Film, best actor was Paul Dano. He played Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy, which I thought was a great movie. You guys all
liked
that
deserved,
movie.
Yeah, much deserved. Much deserved. Yeah.
And then the best actor in the New York Film Critics Circle, Michael Keaton for Spotlight, which
also
we were just
wonderful.
Talking about.
Yeah.
So these are three totally different movies, three totally different people. I mean, Jed, is this at all predictive of what we might see at the Oscars? Are these things indicative? Are they predictive at all?
Not purely predictive.
These early awards.
None of these groups, I mean, if you do correlations and people do, you don't see a direct result. But all of this helps,
yeah.
And it starts building momentum. The Academy voters will start choosing in January. All this attention helps a lot.
And more important, it helps all of these movies get seen. And I'm going to beat the same drum I beat every year around this time, which is that awards season is good,
yep.
Because it provides these filmmakers and these studios a way to get awareness for their projects without having to buy expensive ads on television. They can get free coverage on red carpets at these events. All of these events either had or will have red carpet moments with all of the stars. And even though it looks frivolous from one angle, from another, it's become a hugely important business model for a certain kind of movie to get made, and that is the Spotlights of the world and the Brooklyns of the world. But I think it's great that The Martian and Fury Road got some recognition too, because blockbusters can be just as good and artistic as the scrappiest little indie, and I think they absolutely deserve the congratulations.
Well, Fury Road was one of my favorite films of the year. I saw it in 3D. I'd go back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Well, and just speaking of documentaries, we just have a couple seconds. I'll let people know that the three winners in these three things, National Board of Review, Gotham Independent, and New York Film Critics Circle, Amy, the book, the movie about Amy Winehouse.
Yep.
Over at Gotham, it was The Look of Silence by Joshua Oppenheimer. He directed that movie. And then over at the New York Film Critics Circle, Best Doc, In Jackson Heights. So three totally different movies and three winners.
And two of them are on the short list for the Academy Award. In Jackson Heights cannot be nominated now for an Academy Award.
Mm. It's always something. All right. Mm. Always great to see you guys. Have
thank
a great
you.
Holiday, and we will see you in the new year.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jed Dietz is the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Ann Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more on Maryland Morning. Stick around. Before we go today, a couple of weeks ago, three composers at Clean Cuts Music here in Baltimore submitted five possibilities for us and for you to consider as a new theme song for Maryland Morning. We are very grateful to composers Austin Coughlin, Chris Kennedy, and Louis Weeks for giving us some great music to choose from. You voted on our website, you sent us emails, you called, and you let your voice be heard. Thanks to everybody who sent us their comments about which theme song they liked the best. It was a tough call and a close vote. But here's the music that you'll soon be hearing as the new theme music for Maryland Morning. Austin Coughlin composed this music, and you'll be hearing it regularly real soon. That's all for us today. Nathan Sterner is Maryland Morning's co-host, director, and engineer. Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, and Kathleen Cahill produce the broadcast with assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville provides us coffee. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. And thanks once again to Clean Cuts Music for providing great theme music for Maryland Morning since 2006. Coming up Monday, a look at Baltimore Rent Court, which adjudicates about 150,000 cases every year. The Public Justice Center has a new report coming out Monday, and we'll learn about it from the author, Zephyr Shah. Plus, Jaywin Russick has her weekly theater review, and Jonna McCone introduces us to the music of Sweet Sorrow. We'll see you Monday morning right here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.